Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Good evening. Let me just start off by saying next week we will be off, and the week after that, two consecutive weeks. The next time we'll get together will be January 6th. Okay, before I begin, also one other comment from last week. For those of you who are here, Rabbi Feldman neglected to mention that he felt horrible about it since last week, and he's asked me several times to make sure that I mention that in his discussion on the Rambam, Maimonides, and those who were against him, and he mentioned primarily Rabbeinu Yonah, who was very opposed to the Rambam at first, and then later went around traveling, amending his way, so to speak, the Sha'arei Tshuva, the Gates of Repentance, which was written by Rabbeinu Yonah, which is one of the classic works on Tshuva, which is used and studied regularly in the yeshivas until today, was written as a response to that whole incident in which he wanted to write a book of repentance to repair his own ways from that which he had said negatively against the Rambam. And that's why that work was written. So I have mentioned that and fulfilled that which Rabbi Feldman has asked. Okay, ready to begin. Tonight's class are the exiles and the Muranos. I put that word in there, Muranos, as somebody pointed out to me just a moment ago. The word Murano is a very negative word. It has a negative connotation. It means pig or swine. And it was a very derogatory term which was used for the Jews who converted in 14th and 15th century Spain, which we will learn about. But I use that word anyway because it is familiar, and I recognize its derogatory nature. The appropriate politically correct term would be conversos, which is what they were referred to as well during the time. They were also referred to as anusim, those who were forced into converting. We'll discuss them at great length. I'm going to begin tonight like I begin. I feel every single class. Tonight's class is going to deal with one of the saddest chapters in Jewish history. Except tonight it's really true. And the reason, I say that every time, don't I? The reason for that, if it were not for the Holocaust of this past century, which many of us have either lived through or have had parents or grandparents that lived through, had it not been for the destruction of the 20th century, we would easily, hands down, determine that the story that we're about to learn about tonight was the most traumatic, destructive, horrific chapter in Jewish history. Hands down. It's just that everything was dwarfed by the Holocaust. And indeed, we will see the story that we're going to learn tonight is it actually has at its roots the Holocaust. And many historians actually trace everything that we experienced in the 20th century to what we are about to read about and learn about tonight. 750 years of a strong Spanish community, a community filled with prestige, with wealth, with honor, with influence, with scholars. 750 years. We've been in this country, ladies and gentlemen, 150. How long have we been a strong Jewish presence here? And yet we feel like we've been here forever. 750 years. You would visit your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, your great-great-grandparents. You would go back. Jews in Spain had been a continuous community, a strong community, for 750 years, snuffed out to the last Jew. Judenrein, completely free of Jews. The trauma of the survivors, of those who had converted and who were left behind, is really indescribable, even despite the fact that we're going to try and describe it. Our sages teach us in Pirkei Avos, Al Taldin es Chavercha ad shetagia lemkomo. You may not judge your friend until you get to his place. We're going to learn about the decision that Jews made to convert en masse. We cannot judge, I do not stand here in judgment, until we will be, and we never should be, in the position that they were in. It's not for our place to judge, but to describe, to try to learn, to see what it is that we can understand from that period. What we are going to do tonight is focus on two elements of this story. Number one, if I say the word Spanish Inquisition, what date comes to mind? 1492. We're going to correct that. 1492 is the funeral of the Jewish community of Spain. It was in the death throes for well over 100 years. 1391 is a much more important date rather than 1492, but it's forgotten. Everybody knows 1492. 1492 was the end of the story. The story doesn't even begin in 1391. It really begins in 1250. And we're going to go back because to understand what happened, to understand the response of the Jews who were there, you have to put it in its context. And we will do so as best as we can, because what took place during that time, as I've already mentioned, really lays the groundwork for modern anti-Semitism, which exists until today, and it begins during this time period. It's secondly important for us to understand the unique element of this tragedy, and that is because this is the only time in Jewish history, the only time never seen before and never seen since, of such mass conversion. It was a failure, in Rabbi Wein's word, of the spirit of the Jewish people. And that's never been seen before. Such numbers of people defecting from the Jewish people for another religion. And again, it is not our place to judge. That's not what we're going to do. But to understand how that happened, and then the tragedy of the story, the double tragedy, is then the way that the Jewish community itself dealt with this. Because not only were we being persecuted by the Christians from without, from the outside, but then we're going to have this tremendous tension from within because of the two different ways that the Jewish people, in the same circumstances, responded in two very different ways. All right. So one of the let me just point out before we're going to use two main sources. Number one, that Rabbi Wein is, of course, you know, who I love. So I both his book and from lectures of his on this time period. A second book that I have enjoyed thoroughly, Constantine's Sword. Many of you hopefully have read it or have it by James Carroll. James Carroll is a former minister, historian, and he writes a very unapologetic, frank description from a Christian's perspective of Christian history with the relationship to the Jews. He's actually been is not well received in the Christian world because of how harsh he is to the church in its past histories, but it's a wonderful perspective, and it is fascinating to read the same story from a Jewish, from Rabbi Wein's perspective, and from a Christian's perspective. It is a unique experience, and I highly recommend if you're interested. It's a great read. Constantine Sword. So I referenced it a number of times in the notes. I did not reference it in the official way. I just gave you the page number, even though most of the time he's actually referencing others. But if you're interested in looking into things more, which I hope you will be, that's just where the references are coming from. Okay, let's do a little bit of brief historical background. I'm going to try to cover 150 years really quickly, because I really want to get to the conflict within the Jewish world, but we have to understand a little bit of the historical context. I'm recognizing that I'm going to use broad strokes to discuss that which we really could spend hours on, this particular period of history. I find it fascinating, but we'll do it as quickly, in understanding that I'm obviously skipping entire decades along the way. Number one is the Christian reconquest of Spain. This is where the issue is going to become. When the Jews move to the Iberian Peninsula, if you recall, we discussed this when we discussed Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Who was in control of the Iberian Peninsula when the Jews moved in? It was the Muslims. That's why the Jews came, because they had come from Babylonia where they lived, which was under Muslim control. They were familiar with it. It was cultured. It was scientific. It was philosophical. It was mathematical. It was into architecture. It was into poetry. It was into art. And the Jews came, and they acculturated themselves to that environment. They became upper echelons in that environment. That's where they were. The Muslims, who had entered into the Iberian Peninsula in 711 and had taken over a good chunk of it, almost all the way to the top, to the north of Spain, the Christians did not appreciate that at all. And shortly after that, in the late 700s, beginning the 800s, the 900s, began the reconquest from the north, moving on down. And slowly but surely, they conquer more and more and more of the Iberian Peninsula until the very bottom. Granada was left under Muslim control until rather recently. But the Spaniards basically, the Christians I should say, complete the reconquest of Spain in about the year 1248. It's now solidly under Christian control. Now they inherit a great population of established, wealthy, influential, powerful Jews, which did not necessarily jive well with the Christians. Now, for the Muslims, the Jew wasn't as offensive, shall we say, as to the Christian. To the Christian, the Jew is, by his definition, by his existence, antithetical to the Christian. I have a quote later on. I'm going to start it right off in the beginning to understand what it is that's going on. If you look at the quote, it's on page 3 from John Chrysostom, if I pronounced that correctly. He was an early Christian father. It's on the top of page 3. He's a bishop of Antioch in the early 300s, mid-300s. And he expressed an idea which became very widespread and has been oft-quoted and been repeated by many others. And it goes as follows. Where Christ killers gather, the cross is ridiculed. Now, he means in the synagogues. God is blasphemed, the Father unacknowledged, the Son insulted, the grace of the Spirit rejected. If the Jewish rites are holy and venerable, then our way of life must be false. But if our way is true, as indeed it is, then theirs is fraudulent. Now, in this statement, which we can put in layman's term, the either-or perspective, either we're right or they're right, they can't both coexist, and if we're right, then they are by definition wrong. And you have in this language, and he was a vehemently anti-Semitic early church father, and his words, his teachings were widespread, taught the Christ killers are the problem, and their existence says to us that we're wrong. And we now find ourselves in Spain under the Christian reconquest. And it's a clash. It doesn't work as well as it did under the Muslims. We're going to get back to that quote a little bit later. That quote goes against all those coexistence bumper stickers that we see today. That's a wonderfully American, politically correct perspective. It's beautiful. Like, why can't we all just get along? So from a theological perspective, it's not so simple. It would be nice if you guys, I'm all for us getting along. But theologically, historically, it wasn't always that way. There's been more blood spilled over religion than probably anything else in the history of the world. And the early Christian fathers were big into that this was a major, major clash. Now, the Inquisition is set up, going back to page 1, the Inquisition is set up pretty early in Christian history. Well, the Christianity was started much earlier, but earlier in our story, in the late 1100s, you already have a concept of the Inquisition, which is established to deal with heresy and heretics. It was not established to deal with Jews. It was just not. It's an important thing to understand. I'm sure many of you already know this, but it's important to state, and we're going to state this over and over again. As much as we have this visceral reaction to the word Spanish Inquisition as if it was aimed at the Jews, it wasn't. It was originally created way before our story is going to get started. It was to deal with Christian heretics and heresy and keep the church pure. It was very, in the early years, haphazard. It wasn't established. Pope Gregory the Ninth and Pope Innocent the Fourth really began establishing it. This is in the early to mid 1200s, and they explicitly authorized the use of torture for eliciting confessions. And by 1256, if you're an inquisitor and you use torture, you're completely absolved from any wrongdoing or any punishment. But this is still 1256. We are way before 1492. This is 250 years, before the Spanish Inquisition of 1492. We already have the establishment of inquisitors who were roving bands of Dominican friars going around and trying, torturing, and getting people to confess their heretical beliefs. And it's mostly in Europe. It does not really make its way into Spain just yet. 1242, again, we're still pretty early in our story. 1242, King James I of Aragon issues an edict. Now, we're at the reconquest. This is the end of the reconquest. Christian monarchs have begun to retake Spain, and they are going to now deal with the Jewish problem that exists in Spain. And King Aragon I issues the following edict. It is required, mandated of all Jews to listen to the conversionist sermons of the Dominicans and the Franciscans, which means you would be required by Spanish law as a Jew to listen to a drusha given by a Catholic priest or minister imploring you and explaining to you why, as a Christ killer, you were obligated for the salvation of your soul to convert to Christianity, mandated by Spanish law. And it wasn't long afterwards where it wasn't that you had to go to them, but they then would come to the synagogues. And on every Shabbos afternoon, this is the origin of the drasha, but it wasn't the rabbi giving the drasha. In the middle of your Shabbos services as a religious Jew in Spain, the local, just try to imagine what this would be like, from across the street, the local minister would walk over, and he would take the pulpit, and your shul would sermonize about the salvation of your soul is only through Jesus, and why you need to convert. And the origin of Jews falling asleep during the sermon, it's just a joke because it didn't happen, because I guarantee you, when the minister came in, he came in with his armed entourage, and probably nobody was sleeping. And that's probably why the real origin of falling asleep in the sermon is when it was just the rabbi, you say, oh, it's just the rabbi. And then you fall asleep, you didn't have to worry for your life. But that's what life was like. This is already in the 1250s in Spain. There was already this push in which there was an idea of converting the Jews forcibly, convincing them that that is what needs to be done. 1263, one of the things that they began to do here in Spain is they began to force the Jews into debates. They began to force the Jews as a real active push towards conversion, and there would be predetermined outcomes generally to these debates. They were not necessarily fair. And one of the most famous ones, which we've discussed a couple of times already in this course over the years, is the Ramban and Pablo Cristiani. Pablo Cristiani was himself an apostate Jew. So I want to point out as well, as I mentioned this, the idea of Jews converting in Spain also doesn't start in 1492. Because of all of the pressure, because of the economic pressure, because of the political pressure, because of the philosophical and theological pressure, we already have Jews early in the 1200s who are converting to Christianity. And as often is the case, the Jew who converts becomes the biggest antagonist against the rest of the Jewish community. Pablo Cristiani is one of those such people who challenges the Ramban Nachmanides, the leading sage of the generation in Spain, to a debate in the court of King Aragon I. The Ramban, as was discussed, we're not going to go through this now at great length. I think this was Rabbi Neuberger who talked about this last year. The Ramban asked for freedom of speech, which he was granted, and the Ramban basically wipes the floor with him, and they go through all of the basics. The Ramban wrote up exactly what he says. We have copies of it still today, exactly what he said. It was a victory. It was the famous quote that came out of the king that supposedly said, "I've never seen a man defend such a noble cause so nobly," or something along those lines in translation. Bottom line is, Ramban had to flee with his family for his life following the debate, and he ends up in the land of Israel, and he sets up his Ramban shul, and he reestablishes one of the communities there in Jerusalem. But the Jewish community is downhill from here because of that which is taking place. For the next 100 years or so, it's a constant battle. We're going to skip 100 years, but I'm just trying to set up what life was like. It was beginning to become very unpleasant for Jews, listening to sermons from their Christian neighbors regularly. Pressures, inquisitions are still in that area. And about 100 years later, 1348, the Black Death hits Europe and hits it with a vengeance, as you are all familiar with. The numbers are mind-boggling. A third to half of Europe's population is wiped out, and at this time, no one understands a thing as to what's going on. It was indescribable. It struck everybody, the rich, the poor, Jew, non-Jew, it didn't matter. But the reality is the Jew was actually less struck than other denominations, because the Jew has always been particular with washing his hands, which was far more sanitary than the rest of the world around him. Even if it was simply for bread or in the morning, those twice a day washings was already twice more than the general population. The Jew always buried his dead immediately upon death. So there was slightly better sanitary conditions, which means they were dying slightly less. And Jews were known, of course, to say brachos, so they were constantly mumbling things over their food. And as you're all familiar with, Jews were not the only ones blamed. When all of Europe is dying, many people took the blame. But there was a very famous and well-known Jew poisoning the well conspiracy, which was brought up. And under pressure of torture, a number of Jews in Geneva admitted to it. And that's all it took. And in 1351, there were waves of pogroms which spread through Europe, to decimate an already decimated community. 1351, there were 60 major, 150 smaller Jewish communities completely destroyed throughout Europe, and including in Spain, just from this. But this created, again, just a culture. A culture of the Jew is the problem, and he's free to be attacked as the problem. 15 years following that, from 1355 to 1369, is a civil war for the throne of Castile in northern France between Henry II and his brother Pedro the Cruel. The Jews backed Pedro the Cruel. Henry II eventually takes control and murders personally his brother Pedro the Cruel, which makes you wonder what Henry II was like if he murders Pedro the Cruel. In any case, why this is relevant to us is because it was a 15-year civil war, and Pedro the Cruel, who was supported by the Jews, for whatever political reasons were going on at the time, I cannot tell you. But Henry II stood on a platform of, if I regain power in Castile, I will reenact a law which had actually been on the Spanish books from the year 800, which was that no Jew was allowed to have a position of authority in Spain. In Castile, at least, where he was going to be the king. And he ran on that platform. So it was Jews supporting Pedro the Cruel, and it was Henry II on an anti-Jewish campaign, and Henry II wins, which is bad for the Jews. Except the only thing possibly worse for the Jews happen, which is he realizes the folly of what it would mean to get rid of all the Jews in positions of power, so he lets them stay. So that now all of the masses and the clergy who had supported him on the campaign of ridding the country of this problem called the Jew, the Christ killer, now got their man in power, and he's, so to speak, swayed by the Jews and their money to remain in power, which they do, and that further created just a terrible environment for the Jewish people. And that gives rise to the last of our historical background, a preacher by the name of Ferran, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Martinez. And he preaches from 1378 to 1391. Now again, this is about 150 years since Spain has been Christian again. It's a significant amount of time of anti-Jewish sentiment, of Jews being forced to listen to sermons in their own synagogues and elsewhere. And he then begins just a ferocious anti-Jewish sermons, constantly identifying the Jews as their obstacles to Christian and Spanish wealth and prosperity. And for 13 years he preaches and preaches and preaches. But the one thing that the Jews have protecting them is that both the king and the archbishop at the time would not tolerate open calls to violence. But what happens is, and again, as you see history, we look back over and we see, I can mention 10 years in a sentence, but over time, 10 years of this constant mongering, constant bashing the Jews, and eventually in 1390, in the same year, both the king and the archbishop die, and it was like a match that caught. And all of a sudden in 1391, a wave of horrific pogroms break out. And historians regularly attribute it to a combination of all the factors that we've been talking about, plus this 13-year, he would just travel around talking about how the Jew is the problem. And in 1391, the match lights catches fire. Carroll quotes in his book that June 6th of 1391 is the actual day in which you can say that pressure just explodes, that the first of the terrifying dates in the Judeo-Spanish calendar. Pogroms spread throughout Spain. 50,000 Jews lose their... Okay, it's just hard to like say the word. Like, throughout all of Spain, there are just roving bands. Now, again, this is not like the Crusades, which was in lands of Ashkenaz in Germany and in France, in which there were marauding armies passing through. These were neighbors. These were local Spaniards destroying Spanish towns because the Jews in those towns were the problem. They're the obstacle. And again, there's a lot of poverty around in the pauper and the class section. And so there was just terrible pogroms that break out throughout Spain. What it did is it had two major impacts. Number one, it legitimized organized violence, which was going to continue for decades. Everyone, you'd have random pogroms, and it was okay because there was this widespread, countrywide series of pogroms, and it was really going to decimate the Jewish community. And we're still in 1391, so we're 100 years before the end, but this is the date to be aware of. 1391 is when pogroms break out throughout the country. Just a few years later, by 1414, when the Christians are going to force 14 rabbis to a debate. 12 of those rabbanim, which are leaders of the generation, convert on the spot and just don't even get engaged. So that's what's going to be the state of the Jewish people by the end of this little period. Now, the reason why 1391 is a critical date, as you cross over to page 2, is because of our story. This is a turning point in Jewish history because of what we began discussing, we'll talk about now. And that is, the Christians have from the beginning been saying, convert, 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 convert. That's what they wanted. And in 1391, for the first time in our history, the masses do so. They flock, in the words of the historians as quoted, to the baptismal fonts to dunk themselves in and convert to Christianity. Tens of thousands. By 1425, again, we're way before 1492, a whole century, between 1391 and 1425, in this proud, Spanish, established, wealthy, influential country, it is estimated that between a third to a half of the Jewish population will convert to Christianity. Between a third to a half. There are some numbers which are quoted in both Rabbi Wein as well as in James Cowell's book, up to 200,000 Jews convert. Rabbi Wein personally doubts the accuracy of that particular number. He thinks it's too high. Whatever the number is, 100,000, I don't know, 150,000, enormous amounts of Jewish people convert. That is unheard of. It had been unheard of until that point, and it is unheard of since that point. To convert, we are a people with a long history of martyrdom, of dying al kiddush Hashem for the sake of Hashem's glory. It dates back to Avraham Avinu in the Chumash, who's thrown into the fiery furnace according to the sages because of his beliefs in a single God. It traces its way through many of the stories in Tanakh. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, three of the later prophets, are similarly thrown into a fiery furnace because of their belief in a single God. We have it part of our Hanukkah story, the story of Hannah and her seven children, who are each one after another, when forced to bow down to an idol, refuse in front of her. I quoted it for you if you go to the back page in just to see the language that is mentioned in our history. It's the second on the back page in page 6. Just listen, this is the history of the Jewish people. This is our legacy when they stood together. This is recorded in the story of the Maccabees. Hannah with her last child, her youngest of her seven sons, she's already witnessed six of her sons slaughtered in front of her. She kisses the boy and says, "My son, I carried you in my body for 9 months. I nursed you for 2 years and I have fed you until today. I have taught you to fear God and uphold His Torah. See, heaven and earth, sea and land, fire, water, wind, and every other creation. Know that they were all created by God's word. He created man to serve Him, and He will reward man for his deeds. This king who stands before us knows that he's condemned before God, and he thinks that if he convinces you that God will have mercy on him. God controls your life's breath, and He can take your soul whenever He desires. If only I could see the greatness of your glorious place where we would be illuminated with God's light and rejoice and exult together." As they removed him, Hannah begged to kiss him one last time, and as if speaking to all seven of her children, said, "My children, go tell your ancestor Avraham, you bound but one son upon an altar, and I have bound seven." This is the history of the Jewish people. It's a history of martyrdom, al kiddush Hashem. It's part of our blood. And the Jews in Ashkenaz, during the Crusades from 1096 to 1250, lived this. Every couple of years, another band of soldiers coming through, literally slaughtering Jews. Like we say in our tefillah and our davening, like sheep led to the slaughter. It's just one of the three big mitzvahs. There are three things that a Jew dies for. That no matter what a person says, whatever a person is threatened with, I will not violate. One is idolatry. A life of idolatry is not a life worth living. And a Jew gives up his life, as we have done since the beginning. That's part of our heritage. And here in 1391, and again, I'm not judging. I don't know if I would have done any different. I'm going to get to all the different reasons of what was going on. But in 1391, for the first time in Mass, we've always had individuals, always. But in Mass, and it hits at every level of the Jewish community, poor, rich, learned, scholarly, not so learned. It doesn't matter. Rabbanim, leaders of community, published authors, converting, becoming Christians. Crushes the Jewish community. Literally and figuratively, crushes the Jewish community. Now, it's going to have major, major impacts. Now, I mentioned here in the notes, I'll mention it over here, the term Meranos, historically speaking, is very unclear when it came into being. It means, as I mentioned, it's a derogatory term. Pigs or swine. It was unclear, historically speaking, whether or not it was the Christians who called the Jewish conversos Meranos, because they viewed them as swine who had converted, or whether or not it was the Jews who referred to the Jewish brethren as swine and referred to them as the Meranos. But conversos is the politically correct term, which means those who had converted. And Meranos is the derogatory term. Now, how this happened is many explanations are like, how did it be? How did we get to a point where almost a third to a half of the Jewish people convert? So there were, first of all, the different groups. There were some groups who did it for real. They actually converted. As we've seen, many of the apostates became more Catholic than the Pope and rose in the ranks of the Catholic Church and then themselves persecuted Jews. There are those who believe. How did it happen that we ended up in such a situation? So the various explanations. For example, James Carroll, again, is from a Christian perspective. You see the difference between a Christian perspective and a Jewish. Carroll offers two explanations. How did such a thing happen? So number one, rationalism was sweeping through Europe. And this new movement, the rationalism, clashed with religion, because religion is something that you can't really understand. And the rational movement of mankind to push themselves out of the medieval times and understand and think and explain created a tremendous amount of skepticism, so that religion as a whole was on a weak footing, so that Jews were able to be convinced to, so to speak, jump ship. I don't know, whatever. Maybe yes, maybe no. He also mentions that you're talking now in 1391, where there have now been generations of Jews who've been subject to Christian polemics and sermons. So again, just try to put, like, what does that mean? It means like your grandparents were hearing these sermons already, your parents were hearing the sermons, your kids are hearing the sermons. It's like a lot of years of being surrounded. It's not just like who here knows Christmas carols? All right, so it's not just you're walking through the malls and you hear a carol. We're talking where the Jewish community was well versed in all of the theology of Christianity, well versed in all the reasons that they would say why we were wrong, why we're damned to hell forever, how the only salvation is going to be to generations of that, has an impact. You throw into that serious financial ruin, you throw into that your life is being threatened, and all of a sudden you might see the light after that's become so much a part of your culture. The Jewish philosophers had a different approach. They've always understood of Yosef Yaivitz, the Chassid Yaivitz himself was one of the exiles from Spain, blamed it on the fact that the Jewish belief system in Spain was built on philosophy, as we mentioned at length when we talked about the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. If you asked a Spanish Jew, he writes, why do you believe Torah is true? He would explain on a philosophical plane why it's true. As opposed to, it's true because I believe it's true, because my Baba believed that it's true, and her Baba believed that it's true, and what we would call an Emunah Pshuta. And he writes that a community that was built on philosophy and not on just Emunah, because of Emunah, so when push came to shove, philosophical arguments are only so strong. And that argument became the argument 16th century scholars, Jewish rabbis, when they would speak from their pulpits throughout the 1500s and were left to deal with the pieces of the exile, which had happened 50, 60 years before, regularly turned to that explanation, that it was a condemnation of philosophy as opposed to just, pure, unadulterated, and emunah pshuta in the Torah without the philosophical pinnings. And if you want to know where philosophy got its bad name, which it still has today in many of the yeshiva circles today, this is where it came from. That the calamity of the conversion was blamed on a heavy focus on philosophy and not on just the life of Torah and emunah without all the philosophical underpinnings. Be it as it may, there's another factor which is mentioned both by Rabbi Wein as well as by Carol, and that was the Kabbalistic movement. We're going to combine a lot of different talks he's given over the last few years. It was also beginning around this time. During the time of the Ramban, Rav Moshe de Leon printed up the Zohar and disseminated it for the first time in the 1200s, and it begins to spread. And there are all these Kabbalistic groups that are meeting and studying, which comes together with a strong messianic push. And as each calamity would happen, there was a sense of we're at the end, this is going to be it, the Messiah is coming, and he didn't. And there's a letdown. There's a disillusionment which happens, and the rabbis have always been against messianic fervor for this reason. We're going to have an entire class on the false messiahs, and we're going to reference tonight when we get to that as well. There were three major episodes of false messiahs, plus lots of other little ones, and they're all built on this messianic fervor and calamity, and this must be the end. But it just doesn't happen. And if you put your trust into that this is really the end, and then it doesn't happen, there's a great disillusionment. For all those reasons and more, and there's really one more last reason, which is probably the most significant reason, and that is, most Jews really never intended to convert. There were those who did, and we have lots of explanations as to how that happened. The reality is, a solid majority of them were really just being smart Jews. And smart Jews do what they need to do to survive. That's a reality. Now, it's built on the Rambam, Maimonides, who we studied last week. The Rambam wrote a letter. Now, he was living in Muslim country. And he was asked the following question. It's in the middle of page 2. Should one pronounce the Mohammedan, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, confession, which was basically their approach at conversion, converting Jews to Islam? Says the Rambam, verily one who preferred to suffer martyrdom in order not to pronounce this confession has done nobly and well, and his reward is great before the Lord. He may be regarded as supremely virtuous, as he was willing to surrender his life for the sanctification of the name of God, blessed be he. Certainly you should do that. Now, Islam is not considered idolatrous by Jewish standards. They worship a single God, who you cannot see, who created everything. They just think that Muhammad was a prophet, so we don't buy into that. But it's not idolatry. A Jew, for example, is allowed to go into a mosque. He's allowed to daven in a mosque. Catholic Christianity, Catholicism, is a different story. Really murky. Once you start getting into that quote, which we had seen from John Chrysostom earlier about the Father and the Spirit and the Son, that's much more stamped as idolatrous. But the Rambam is not talking about that. The Rambam's talking about Islam. So he says, certainly you should give up your life. But, says the Rambam, should one, however, inquire of me, shall I be slain, or shall I pronounce this confession? What should I do, Rabbi? Says the Rambam, utter the formula and live. To be sure, one should not continue to live in such an environment, but until the opportunity presents itself to leave, one should be confined to the privacy of his home and conduct his transactions in secret. Muslim country, says the Rambam, if you can pretend to be a Muslim and live as a Jew until you can get out, you should do it. Now the Rambam was a Sephardi Ashkenazi. He's Sephardi. He had to flee already from Spain centuries earlier when the Almohades, I was mispronounced them, they came in and they took over the country, so they were fanatical sects, so he had to leave. But he already puts into motion, this is one of the earliest places where we have against this idea of being a martyr. The Rambam says, well, wait a minute, but if you can do it in secret and you don't really mean it, and then you just buy yourself some time until you can get out, for sure you should live. The Jews in Spain are dealing with Christianity, which is a different story. Would the Rambam have said the same thing? Unclear. But to the great number of Jews, This was survival. And in mass, they convert. Now, what happens here, whatever the reasons, whether they meant it or not, there's a large new class of people, 100,000, 150,000, unclear, but generally speaking, overnight, whether or not it took all in 1391, by 14, in a generation, massive numbers of Jews who become Christians. And we're going to see the Jewish world doesn't want them, and the Christian world is not going to want them. And a new sect, an entire new class of people who we'll call the conversos, is going to be created. Now, let's just try to understand a little bit of the way. Just taking our community as an example, just imagine what this is like if we should be protected from such things. All of a sudden, things fall apart. We have three churches, if you ever paid attention, one just two houses down that way, one house that way, and a block down that way. So we're like surrounded by churches. And we are blessed to live in a country where you probably have to stop and think about that. That's right. We do live in a community with three churches. If you lived in 1300 Spain, you wouldn't be like, oh, that's right, I didn't think about that. You would be very well aware of the fact that there's danger lurking everywhere. And if there were pogroms, which randomly occurred and ravaged the Jewish community, and you were told that if you remained a Jew, you weren't going to be able to keep your livelihood, you're going to lose your business, you're going to lose your ability to earn a living, and what you needed to do to survive was to convert. And how do you convert? You go to the local church, and you dunk yourself in their baptism pool, and you get a little document that says you've converted. And you notice that as the lines get longer and longer, are they going to be able to keep track of every single one of us? Are they going to know the difference between whether or not, so maybe I put a tree up. Like, think about what it would mean. Like, how would you have to pretend that you were a Christian? So maybe I'd put lights on Christmas time. Maybe I'll buy a tree. What do I need to do to pretend and just blend it in enough that I can make it? So there were many Jews who just did just survival techniques. But you had a tremendous tension that now arises between those who stick it out and are persecuted and don't have the business opportunities anymore, fall into a state of poverty, and your neighbor, literally just take a community. Right? So go up and down our community. Jew, non-Jew, our houses, right? We're intimate. So on your block, three families convert, keep their jobs, keep their parnasa, everything is fine with them, and their neighbor across the street and their neighbor next door maintain themselves as Jews and lose all their parnasa. And maybe had a child killed in a pogrom. Now, they're not making this like maybe. That's what happened. And they're looking across the street at their neighbor who's living a life of wealth, and they come over to you and they say, we're just pretending. We're really still Jews. How do you respond to that? That's very tough. Well, those Jews who are now the conversos, who the Jews in their neighborhood, you know, just as an example, I just tonight at Risky mentioned to the kids, I was telling a story about something else that I heard about the Korean War. I was telling a story of somebody who just told me how he was going to be drafted and how he got out of it. But he got out of it in a legal way, as they didn't want to be a draft dodger. But she mentioned that she has a friend whose father lost a brother in the Korean War because he refused to be a draft dodger. He was an American, and he was drafted, and he was killed. And how her friend's father's family, who lost a brother, couldn't relate to all of his fellow yeshiva students who got out of the war. I don't say, like, my son went, did what he was supposed to do, and paid with his life. And you hid. And now you're going to go around and dance how great everything is that you made it? I lost a son. And for their entire lives, it haunted them. So we have a whole community dealing with this. half the community converts, keeps their jobs, keeps their parnasa, and half is in poverty and in mourning. Well, something else happens, because the Jew, who used to be called Yaakov, who was despised, who everybody was jealous of him from his Christian neighbors, who was wealthy and more prestigious than them, now shows up as one in their church. And he's still despised, they're still jealous of him, and they still don't like him. But now he's protected by the church, because he's one. And he sits in the back, and he kibitzes with his formerly Jewish friend, and they mumble something, and they go home. How do you feel as a Christian about him? I mean, you also don't like him. Even though that's what you wanted. You wanted to get them to convert. And now they did. Now there's this whole group of Jews who are now in your church and don't really integrate. They do all the right things, sort of. They show up at the party. And you begin to become suspicious. You know, they're not eating with us. Or they don't show up to our Saturday parties, or they do weird things, but they kept their jobs and their wealth and their prestige. And now you begin, as the Christians, to think, you know, we've been had. So the Jews don't want the conversos because you abandoned ship. And the Christians begin to have serious doubts. And what happens now, the church is not prepared for this. Because in mass, there are huge numbers of Christians. They're not prepared to teach them how to be good Christians. And a good number of these Jews don't really want to be good Christians. They can't keep track of them. And not only are they still envied, but now, what to make matters worse is the church is responsible for protecting them, because this is what we wanted. What can be better, you would have said to the church in 1390, than having 200,000 Jews convert. In 1425, you say, what could have been worse than having had 200,000 Jews convert? Because when you force someone to do anything, you're bringing problems onto yourself. Because you forced it. They don't want it. So in theory, what you're thinking is, this is their salvation, is what we need to do. But we know the Jews are a stubborn people. So even after they converted, some of them converted for real and they believed it, and they became, as I mentioned, more Christian than the Pope. But a great number of them really didn't buy into it. And this caused great, great problems. And then what began to happen in the mid-1400s, as this first generation grows up, and Jewish families are trying to maintain themselves and their Jewish beliefs to their children, the next generation, there began to arise old Christians and new Christians. They began to be identified as pure Christians and one of those converso families, even identified by the Christians as a converso family. Carroll believes, and he quotes other historians as well, who writes, this is one of the most fundamental shifts in world history as far as how the world relates to the Jew. Because until this point, the Jew was reviled because of his belief. He believes something different than us. He killed our Savior. And if only he would believe like me, he would be saved. And now, for the first time in history, in mass, the Christians looked at the Jews after they changed their belief. And they do believe the same things, and they said, you're still different. You're a Jew, you have Jewish blood, it's impure to our Christian race. And the modern form of anti-Semitism that we know and love was born out of the conversos. Was born out of the Christian rejection of a Jew who now said, I believe like you, I want to be like you. And they said, we still don't want you. Why not? Wasn't that all that you wanted me to do before? No, it's because of your race. You're a Jew, you have Jewish blood. And that was the origin of something new. Historian David Kurtzer writes in the New York Times in 1998, we can learn much from the newly opened archives of when they opened up the archives of the Inquisition. And he writes, the explanation of what made the Holocaust possible is to be found in no small part in the files of the Inquisition. The Inquisition, which is going to go after Jews who converted. And they're going to prosecute them and pursue them to the ends of the earth. These documents will deepen our knowledge of how for centuries the Roman Catholic Church conditioned the European population to view the Jews as inferior intrinsically. That was a shift. Because until this point, it's because of their belief system. And they just won't believe what we believe. And now it's going to become a racial hatred. This is going to manifest itself, Carol points this out brilliantly, to the extent that in the Holocaust, the opposite's going to happen, in which Hitler is going to pursue Christians because of their Jewish blood, because of the taintedness. They've already converted. And they're going to be pursued as Jews because of that which was in, and it could have been centuries ago. But there's this concept of this racial, and it's that anti-Semitism, that sense really is born out of this not knowing what to do with all these people, and they didn't trust that they were real, but now that they were saying they were real, something else developed deep within the consciousness. And what's going to come out of the Inquisition, which we are going to describe right now. So the idea arose in 1450, as I have, of this defiled pure blood of the Christians by the Jewish rites. Edicts were passed in 1451 by the King of Castile against conversos holding office, where now the Jewish assimilated insider was to be more feared than as a dissenting outsider. That's new. As an outsider is one thing. Now he's on the inside and I fear him even more. What happens as the 1400s go on, and now we have this problem of this large community of conversos, who are many of them just trying to protect themselves and try to pretend and get away with this as long as they can. The Inquisition, which has existed for almost 200 years, the Inquisition is going to be brought to Spain. It's going to be brought with a vengeance. Ferdinand and Isabella marry in 1469. This is now 80 years after the mass conversions begin. So it's a generation later, a full generation. 80 years later, we've had conversos now living in Spain for 80 years. And they marry, if you remember, we spoke about this 2 weeks ago. Who arranged their wedding? Abraham Senor. The Jew arranged for the wedding between Aragon and Castile to really strengthen Spain. But they create what the church used to call the Catholic monarchy, and they were just fanatic Catholics, and they were bent on ridding Spain of the Jewish presence, and they were therefore and thereby going to create that dynasty because it was the Jew who was the problem. And they established the Inquisition in 1482, and they put it under the authority of Fray Thomas de Torquemada, and he is just the villain in Jewish history because for 12 years he is going to ruthlessly pursue the conversos in a way that the savagery and the onslaught, as was quoted, of the converso was without equal in the history of any tribunal in the Western world. If you lived in Spain between 1482 and 1492, it was just terror because no one was safe. No one. Because if you were a Christian or a converso, you never knew if you were going to be accused of really being a Jew. If you ate the wrong food at the wrong time or the right food at the wrong time, everything was done in secrecy. And that Inquisition created many of the things that we'll see throughout history. Rabbi Wein points this out, of the idea of secret informers, sudden disappearances, preemptory secret executions, public executions. They would come into a town, they'd take over the local church, they'd bring everybody in, and anybody they found suspect was burned at the stake, was publicly killed, and like you couldn't speak to anybody. Conversos, so to speak, one another, like you couldn't say you were friendly with this one or you knew that one, because you never knew who was an informer, who was your friend, who was your enemy. Everybody was trying to put themselves on the side of the inquisitors, because if you were on their side, then maybe be protected. And it was just a panic-stricken, terror-ridden time. Those 10 years were disastrous. But this is the end of the line already. The Spanish community has been in rapid decline from 1391 already. It's almost 100 years of disaster that culminates in the 12 year of the actual Inquisition they soon turned to Jews themselves and others. Originally, they were only pursuing the conversos, the ones who had actually converted, and now they needed to make sure that they remained in their Christian perspectives. They then began persecuting Jews. And that led to, in 1492, the final edict of Ferdinand and Isabella to rid the country of the Jews, and the different historical accounts say 3 months or 4 months or 6 months in any case, to get out of the country. Out of about the 400,000 Jews who were left in Spain at the time, half leave and another 200,000 convert. Faced with the choice of convert or die, convert or leave, they just converted. One of the classic differences you find, Abraham Senior, who I mentioned before, and Don Isaac Abarbanel, both of them were of the highest in the Spanish government, and they took the opposite path. Abraham Senior converts to Christianity, and Don Isaac Abarbanel leaves everything behind and leaves penniless together with his people. If you want to read just a horrific description on your final page, the addendum, there's an eyewitness account which was quoted again by both Rabbi Wein and by James Carroll, by a Catholic priest, describing how the terms were fixed. The Jews sold, they left. The last Jew left Spain on August 2nd, 1492, which corresponds to the Hebrew date of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av was the day that the final Jew was kicked out of Spain. They sold, disposed of their property for a mere nothing, asking Christians to buy. They found no buyers. You're leaving. What do I need to buy your house for? Fine houses and estates were sold for trifles. A house was exchanged for a mule. A vineyard given for a little cloth or linen. The rich Jews paid the expenses of the departure of the poor, practicing toward each other the greatest charity, so that except for a very few of the poorest, they would not become converts. In the first week of July, they took the hardship of the road upon themselves and left the land of their birth. 750 years, children, adults, older, youngsters on foot, gentlemen mounted on donkeys, other animals in carts, they continued their journey, each one to the port to which they had to go. And they went along the roads and through the fields with great travail and misfortune, some falling, others rising, some dying, others being born, others falling ill, so that there was no Christian who did not feel sorry for them. And always, wherever they passed, the Jew was invited to be baptized. And some, because of the hardship, converted and remained, but those were very few. The rabbis strengthened their resolve and made the women and young people play music on pipes and tambourines to cheer the people, and thus they left Castile and arrived at the ports of the sea. Those who would embark, as soon as they glimpsed the sea, let out shouts. Men and women, old and children, in their prayers, they beseeched God for mercy and hoped to see some miracle of God, that He might open a path for them in the sea. Rabbi Wein quotes that 50,000 Jews died just on the roads trying to get out of Spain. It was literally, until our times, we would have described as the greatest Holocaust in Jewish history. Entirely snuffed out, the destruction of the community, the survivors, those who remained, were literally, as we refer to our survivors today, they were indeed just like that, simply survivors. Many went to Portugal, where they were expelled just 5 years later, and the rest settled all over the globe, but primarily in the Muslim world, in the new Ottoman Empire, which had, the Muslims had conquered Constantinople, and they had established the Ottoman Empire throughout Turkey, that area, and Holland, Italy, Israel, and the New World. Many of the original Jews were all Sephardim, who were running away from Spain, both as conversos and as openly Sephardish Jews, settled in New Mexico and in North America. And we have many, many communities such as that. Interestingly, a lot of the conversos came. The Inquisition followed them to the New World and pursued them there as well. There is a group that meets today. And so every summer, there's the Crypto-Jewish American Jewish Studies, they're called. They hold a conference. It's in the Texas area because many of the conversos settled in Mexico, and that's where they're heavily populated. I have had it in my 7 years here, I believe, if I recall correctly, three Spanish-speaking, South American non-Jews who came to my office and claimed to be crypto-Jewish. And they all have stories of candlesticks in the attics and grandmothers who told them wacky stories that they never understood. And their family tree is like a bush because they only marry cousins and they throw their nails and they burn them. They all have lots of different customs, which doesn't establish them as a Jew, this far away. But there's a group which meets until today as the Crypto Jews, who still have this heritage. It's not a surprise that they estimate 8 out of 10 Spaniards have Jewish blood in them because of all of these mass conversions. But my mother has a friend who lives in New Jersey. Barbara Kessel is her name. She wrote a book called Suddenly Jewish. She traces, you know, 2 dozen stories of people who found out later in life that they were Jewish. And she has an entire chapter on crypto Jews. So I called her today just to get to ask her. I wanted to get a copy of it. I couldn't find mine. I left it out to someone. So she told me that she had gone to this conference in Texas a couple years back when she was writing the book. And they, in the beginning of the conference, they have all these little round tables for people to gather together. So she sits down and she begins schmoozing and she said, hi, my name is Barb. I live in New Jersey. I'm writing a book on crypto Jews. And she said, literally, the 5 people at the table stood up and walked away. The Inquisition didn't end in Spain until 1836. 1836 is when the Inquisition was formally abolished. 1821 in Portugal. There's just a history of, this is like in our family, and if you're not in and one of us, like nothing doing. And it's still that way. Now, the tragedy, as I mentioned, of the ramification for the Jews. So what this did is it split a community, tore the Jewish world apart. Because as I've said, how do we now relate to these Jews who abandoned ship, who converted, who saved their parnasa, saved their livelihood, spared their families, and then wanted to come back? So there were 2 elements of this tragedy. Number one was in Spain itself for that 100-year period. From 1391 to 1492, you're living next door, your neighbors converted, and you have to figure out how to deal with them as they continue to prosper and live a good life while you're in poverty and in mourning. But then what happened is the exile. The exile in 1492, which ended Spanish Jewry. And now the exiles went and founded new communities. They founded communities in Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire, in Israel, in Egypt. And then the conversos, over time, over the next 50 to 100 years, are able to trickle out. And they're able to get out of Spain and Portugal. And they show up. And they come to your community and they say, "Oh, we made it." And the community said, "Who are you?" And they said, "You remember, we live next door." "That's right, we remember you. You were the Christian next door." And they said, "We were just fooling everybody. We were pretending it wasn't real." Then we have the second tier of the tragedy. Now what? Now what? So the Jewish communities were resentful of the conversos. And they didn't want them. Throughout the 1500s, the 1600s, whereas thousands... remember, if the numbers are even close to accurate, where we have a conversion of, say, 100,000 in 1391, we have another 100, 150,000 in 1492, that's a lot of Jewish families. And even if most of them maybe had communities at first, eventually they assimilated. But there are always strong individuals who maintain their Jewish identity. And then by the thousands begin to trickle out, and the Jewish communities don't know what to do with them. They don't want them. The rabbis, and we're going to go through this with our remaining time, ruled over and over and over again, accept them with compassion. But the rabbis can stand on their pulpits and say that from today till tomorrow, if your son or daughter or mother or father isn't with you in North Africa or in the Ottoman Empire, and there was not a Spanish family who did not suffer a loss, it was impossible. And now the family next door shows up, that's asking a lot of them to open up their hearts and say, "Of course you're welcome back." So the rabbis paskined over and over again, accept them, but there was resentment. There was. There were many Spanish families who would refuse to marry into descendants of conversos. They would refuse to give them positions of authority in their shuls. "You want to be the president of the shul? We're going to read a shala. You want to be the chazan in my shul? Your father converted. Your father lived next door to me. He converted. You will not daven for me in my shul and lead me in Kedusha, Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzvakot, not in my shul. There was a lot of tension. There was a lot of tension. Many of the Sfardim adopted a Samach Tet, Sat, at the end of their name, which many believe stood for Sfardi or Shintet Tahar. Pure Sfardi. My family was pure. My family didn't convert. My family suffered the consequences but stayed true to the God of Israel. And that family will remain pure and would not intermarry, take back. What I want to share with you is a series of questions, responsa, real life questions, not so much to focus on the answers, but to put into real terms what it was like to be a Sephardi Jew after the expulsion when these new Jews came in. I have them for you on the bottom, starting on page 4. I'll go through a couple of them in our remaining 15 minutes. Pay attention to the dates of the rabbis who were asked these questions, just to get a sense of what it was like. This is the first one, it's from the Tshuva of the Rivash. This is still way before the Inquisition. He died in 1407, but that's already after. He died 20 years after the original mass conversion of 1391. And a woman obtains a get, but she and her husband were both Meranos. They both had converted, as were all the witnesses to the divorce. So she shows up with the get. She shows up in the Jewish community and says, I want to be part of the Jewish community. I'd been married before, but I have a documentation that I've been divorced. But I was a Merano, a converso. My husband was a converso. The witnesses who signed on my get were all conversos. Can I marry in? So you're the Rav. What will allow her to marry in? Only if the two witnesses who signed that divorce document are valid. If they're valid, she can marry. If they're not, she's stuck. How do you rule? How do you rule on the woman who comes in front of you and says, I want to come back and I want to be able to get married? And her neighbor says, yeah, I know those witnesses. Yeah, they converted. I saw they had a Christmas tree in the window. Did they mean it? Did they not mean it? These were the shilas. These were what you had to deal with in terms of figuring out their lives. Next question, a little bit later in history.
How did he rule?
He ruled that, he said it depends on whether or not they were real, and you have to, that's basically how he ruled. And the answer is, I don't know. This is, again, he's answering in the first 20 years of when they began to convert, which means you're talking first generation, where it's indeed very likely that they did everything correctly. What do you do, and this is really where he talks about this, what do you do if somebody comes forward and says, I saw them violating Shabbos publicly? I saw it. And if the witnesses were here, they would say, we're afraid of our lives. We didn't really mean it. As soon as we got out, we would change. But you signed the get when you weren't keeping Shabbos. You're not a valid witness. What do we do with the woman in front of us? Two brothers. Next question. Avram and Ephraim. They live in the city of I'm sure it's not pronounced oven, but that's what it looked like. Their father, who was known as Shner, upstanding Jew, renounced his faith and converted to Christianity. So what do? You have two teenage boys, and their father's got a business. And the father's about to lose his business. He's going to lose everything. And he says, I can't deal with this. And he converts. But the boys are already young men, 18, 19, 20. And they don't have the same fiscal pressures that the father does. So they come to shul the next week. And they want to get an aliyah. Well, the halacha is, if a Jew converts out, you don't call his children up by his name. Even though last week they were Ephraim and Avraham ben Shner, not anymore. Shner's out. Your father converted. He's in the church across the street right now. So we need to call you up by your grandfather's name. That's the halacha. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. And the boys say, we're embarrassed. It's bad enough that we have to go home, and when we go home for Shabbos lunch, our father's a Christian. And he went to church that morning because he was afraid. And now in my own shul, you're not going to call me up by the way you called me up last week? I want to be called up by my father's name. And the Gabbai says, we don't do that in our shul. If you're out, you're out. So the Shaila comes to the Rav. What should we do? The Gabbai of the shul says, this is a pure place. We don't deal with... We're suffering. This is the way the Jewish people. If you're out, you're out. And the children say, please, just what's the big deal? Just call us up by our father's name. Don't embarrass us. The Gabbai says, we have standards here. Your father abandoned ship. You're the Rav. What do you do? Who do you side with? The Gabbai? Your standards? Do you send a message that we're all in? Or do you look at these two boys and you say, the boys, they're just, like, they have it hard enough. Like, okay, we'll make an exception. Make an exception here, maybe an exception again. What do you do? He's asking that you should call him up by the father's name. But I want to give you the human sense as to what they were dealing with. The testimony of a former Marano regarding events that occurred while he was a Marano acceptable in a Beis Din. An interesting question. Jew shows up from Spain, he gets out, and a case comes before the Beis Din, he's back to the Jewish people, everything is good, and he says, oh yeah, I remember when I was in Spain, I saw so-and-so's husband died, she's allowed to remarry, her husband's dead. This is an important halacha, especially in those days people were dying young, woman wants to remarry, we need testimony if her husband's alive or if he's dead. He says, I saw. But he was not practicing as a Jew when he saw the man die. So we accept his testimony. Is he allowed to testify to that? If at the time that he saw what he's witnessing about now, testifying to, he was a converso at the time, and now he's a full-fledged Jew. What do you do with him? Why not? Well, again, the halacha is, because if at the time, he's not a Shomer Shabbos, he's not keeping the laws of the Torah, from all looks and appearances, he's a Christian, we don't accept such testimony. But he says, it wasn't real, I was just trying to protect myself. You believe him?
Yes.
Yeah? I'm giving you all this, you can look them all up, you can look at one of these questions. How about this next one? I referenced this a little bit earlier. 15 years ago, Yaakov Francis suddenly renounces Judaism and converts to Christianity. He immediately regretted his deed and repented. He has kept his face covered for the last 15 years as a sign of remorse and has been steadfast in his repentance ever since. Is he qualified to be appointed as a chazan or a shochet? So the reason why this is a question is because if he were a kohen, we would not allow him to duchen. Because once you profess your belief in another God, you can no longer duchen. You can't bless the people on behalf of God. You're out. You can be a Jew again. You can't duchen. Duchening as a Kohen is a right and a privilege, and you could lose that. But he's not a Kohen. He just wants to be the Shochet. But he had a brief stint in Christianity. He tried it. And then he said, no, it's wrong. Would you buy meat from him? 15 years ago, he's been walking around with his face covered for 15 years. And he says, I was a shochet before, I want to be a shochet now. I want to daven for the amud. I want to be a chazin. And the Jews in the shul say, he converted. 15 years ago. I've been repentant ever since. And they say, that's really nice, but you know, there's an empty seat next to me where my son should be sitting, but you know, there were a lot of pogroms and you converted to protect yourself. It was just for a year. I repented. Would you eat his meat? Badat. He's going to shecht it badat. But he's got a stain on his record. Look at the year of the question. We're in the 1560s. This is 80 years after the original after the expulsion from 1492. So they're not in Spain anymore. They're in a community in North Africa. And such a Jew has that stain on his record. You would eat it? You wouldn't eat it? So the Rav paskind, you have to eat it, absolutely. He could be a chazan and you could eat his meat. That's what the Rav paskind. Do you think they ate his meat in town?
No.
So this is where you have, you know, the Rav can paskind all he wants. Are you going to bring meat in that was shechted by a person who converted? These are real life, tough situations. You're talking about survivors. In 1560, the person who was asking the shiloh of that community were all children of survivors. All of them. They were all moved when they were children from Spain. They traveled those roads. They gave up everything. They reestablished themselves. And now such a person wants to shecht their meat. Look at the next one. This is also from the mid to late 1500s. 40 years ago, Yaakov and his family, refugees from Portugal, which means they were banished from Spain, they went to Portugal, they were banished from Portugal, they find a safe haven in Turkey. Morano's Jews forced to convert to Christianity by the Portuguese government, and upon arriving in Turkey, they settle in Salonika, and there they're blessed with two upright sons, Reuven and Shimon. So now we have children of conversos, Reuven and Shimon, which is probably not the real names, those are classic names just for whoever, Reuven and Shimon, they go to yeshiva. Reuven becomes a Talmud Chacham. Reuven, the child of this converso family who settles in Turkey, gets a position as a Rav in a neighboring town. And one of the members of that community, who deemed himself a scholar and now feels overshadowed by the new rabbi, begins to malign him, stating that Reuven is not qualified to be a Rav, because not only was Reuven's father a Morano, but his mother was in fact non-Jewish. And he's spreading this libel wherever he goes, to the point that some of the members of the community are beginning to have their doubts about their rabbi. Because they start asking around, and sure enough, it's true, everybody knows. Reuven's father came from Portugal, not with the exiles. He came a few years later when the Moranos were able to trickle out and settled in a community, had a couple of children, child grows up, goes to yeshiva, becomes a Rav. And now one guy in the town is spreading rumors. Yeah, you know this new Rav that you hired? His father was a Morano, you know. You know the Moranos, he even married a Christian woman. This guy's not Jewish. Your Rav is not Jewish. They ask the Rav. They send a shiloh. What should we do? It's true. He's a Morano. His grandparents are Moranos. How are we supposed to handle this? The community is now not sure they want to hire him, whether or not he's even Jewish or not. So you paskin that he's Jewish. You don't have to worry about it. And unless you have other proof otherwise. But these are the shilohs. That it could be 60 years after Portugal, and now you got questions on your Rav of questionable descent because his father escaped from Portugal. But he didn't escape with the exiles. He escaped a couple of years later with the Moranos. He had some harsh words for him too. This next one we'll end with this, and you could check some of the. Happened in Italy. This is a great one. Happened in Italy. Many of the conversos went to Italy as well. That a Morano was arrested by the Inquisition, who investigated him and found that he was circumcised and practiced Judaism. Now again, look at the dates of this question. Somewhere between the late 1500s. So the Inquisition is pursuing the conversos to Italy way after the expulsion. This is now 60, 70 years later after the expulsion. There was a family who was practicing as a Christian, and the Inquisition caught and said, "You're still believing Jews. You gave your son a bris." So on the outside, we're talking about a Christian family. But they gave a bris to their son 60 years after the expulsion from Spain and Italy. In the mid to late 1500s, you have Christian families secretly hiring a mohel to give a bris to their son. And they were caught. The verdict was for the Morano to recant, to renounce his Judaism and beg the priest's forgiveness. And then to confess his sins, he had to divulge the identity of the person who had performed the circumcision. Whereupon the Inquisition would then go after the mohel with all their might. And the Morano couldn't handle it. And he did. He returned to the faith of the Christians. He revealed the name of the mohel. And the Inquisition pursued the mohel with their customary methods. The mohel learns of what's going on. And he flees to a distant country and sent for his wife and children. Listen to this question. This is unbelievable. Since he was highly skilled at his profession and also taught bris milah to others, he had been earning his livelihood in this manner. By betraying the mohel, the Morano deprived him of his source of income. Is the Morano responsible, and can his property be attached to pay for the mohel's expenses in saving himself and having his family join him, and for his being prevented from earning his livelihood? So that this Morano is still part of the community enough, even after being caught by the Inquisition, where the Jewish community feels it has rights to ask the question and say, you ratted on him, he has to flee the country, you're responsible for paying for his lost livelihood because you ratted him out. Can you imagine this question in 1560s Italy? After the Morano gives in to the Inquisition and professes his faith in Christianity again, the Jewish community says, well, we're taking your property because you have to pay for the mohel who had to flee. And the answer, the Rav said, well, it depends. If this Morano, this converso, could have gotten away with giving either a different person's name or not giving the mohel's name, then he's at fault. But if he had no choice because of whatever circumstances that he had to, then he's considered an onus. He's considered he didn't have a choice to spare his life. So he's not responsible for the mohel's life and the mohel's family. A whole tshuva. This is the responsible of this period of time, how to deal with these particular questions. With that, I will conclude this. It's just a terribly dark time in Jewish history. I'm just trying to give a human element to the difficulty of what it is like for, again, in 1391 to lose a third of the Jewish people to Christianity. 100 years later, just a terrible 100 years, a horrific century of pogrom and persecution, culminating in the final expulsion from Spain. This is going to give rise to our next series of classes. False messiahs are going to give birth out of this. There's an entire generation of survivors. The Jews, the Sephardim who make it out, are by definition, if there's a Sephardi alive today, he's a survivor. He's descended from survivors. Because all of Spain, all of Portugal were just knocked out. And then the Arab lands of Egypt and Turkey were filled with those Spaniards who left, who reestablished their communities there in Mexico and in the southern United States as well. And we have this converso community which exists till today, not as Jews anymore. Way too many years have gone by for the actual Jewish lineage to still be intact, but families with traditions of Jewish blood who still have Jewish practices which date all the way back. And the tension that existed between those two communities, the converso community, the Jewish community, which is, as you imagine it, just impossible for us. As I started with, one cannot judge. We cannot judge the conversos who converted. We cannot judge the Jews who wouldn't take them back. It's beyond our experience as Jews living here in a land where we can do what we want and we're protected by the government to appreciate. But it's important from a Jewish historical perspective to understand where we came from and the particular calamity of the 15th century of Spanish Jewry. Yeah?
One thing I think that seems to me is by the time of Egypt in 1492, the universal elite, right, already the Inquisition had pursued the conversos that they had converted previously.
Yeah.
So it seems to me So while another 200,000 Jews converted, when they too would have been subject to the pressure of the
survival. Survival. You're faced with a choice of sell your house for pennies, leave with nothing, with your I got a house full of young children, where am I going? Or I'll be able to, either you really converted or you thought you would fall. I mean, it's just, that's why I say we cannot judge what it is like to say, go. Just pick up and leave penniless. There's no email, there's no trains. It's like, you have a cart and a couple belongings and a family and maybe you have elderly grandparents or parents and children. The choice is indescribable. So some they said, you know, I got my money, my house, I'm going to stay. I got wealth, why would I give this up? James Carroll, Constantine Sword, it's a really wonderful book. I highly recommend it. I'll see you all 2 weeks. You guys were off, 9:15. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.